You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Welcome to the Speculative Fiction Cantina with your host, S. Evan Townsend.
And hello, this is the Speculative Fiction Cantina. It's your weekly hypodermic injection of science fiction, fantasy, horror, alternate history, steampunk, cyberpunk, and things weird and wonderful in the world of books and writers. I am your host. I am S. Evan Townsend. I write science fiction and fantasy novels that cause thrills and rapid page turning. I am not responsible for paper cuts. To learn more about me and my 10 novels, go to my website, s7townsend.com. That's my name, s7townsend, squished together for one word, .com, or you can Google me, s7townsend, and my website should be the first thing that comes up. You can learn there about the Treasures of Space series, which is my latest series, 3 books of science fiction. But the show's not about me, it's about my guests, and today on the Speculative Fiction Cantina, we're pleased to welcome writers Pamela K. Kinney and Judith D. Howell. Now, if you'd like to speak with our guests, ask a question, make a comment, then please call 347-945-7246. That's 347-945-7246. And then press 1 to be put in the queue for going on the air once you get here. If you don't press that 1, on your phone to be put in the queue for going on the air, I won't get the signal that says you want to go on the air, and you won't get to go on the air. So that's 347-945-7246, and then be sure to press that 1 key to get in the queue for going on the air. Finally, if you'd like more information about my guests, including links to their websites, links to their social media, links to their books, it's on my blog at blog.s7townsend.com. That's blog.s7townsend.com. Or if you're on my website, just click the Write Your Thoughts link at the top of the page, and that will take you to my blog. So, hello, Pamela.
Oh, hello there. Thanks for having
me. How are you today? Oh, thanks for being here. How are you today?
Doing fine. It's been a kind of a busy day today, but nothing to do with writing other mundane stuff, you know.
Yeah. Life gets in the way sometimes. So Pamela, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, obviously I'm a writer. I also like to paranormal investigate. That's just a hobby I got into due to nonfiction ghost books I had. So I started that after that with groups, and I actually kind of do a kind of a paranormal reality show out of it with it, because I have a co-producer who actually is a filmmaker who does that. It kind of helps when you're writing it, you know, the real stuff, right?
Right.
I like to read a lot, write a lot, and actually go on to conventions. And actually, in the next couple of weekends, I'll be going to conventions because I'm a guest at them. So.
Great. Well, it's great to have you here. Judith, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm glad to be on the show.
Hey, we're glad to have you. Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I've been writing for a long time. I started writing when I was in high school and was editor of the newspaper for 3 years. And I'm from the general area of New Orleans most of my life. But was raised in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I'm now living in Virginia. And I had my first short story published in 1979, and have published several short stories since then. Now that I've written 2 novels and I'm working on a third in the trilogy, I'm going to book signings and things like that in Virginia, and you know, trying to get my name recognized out there.
Yeah, yeah, you gotta do that. In fact, I'm at RadCon in Tri-Cities, Pasco, Washington, to for the same reason, get my name out there. So
right,
great.
Yeah, yeah.
Pamela, tell us about how the Vortex changed my life.
Tell about it. Okay, it's set in Richmond area here. I figured it'd be kind of nice, which I found out from a lot of places they were happy to hear that, which is probably true. I mean, most, it's an urban fantasy. This woman, she's ordinary. I mean, usually when you have an urban fantasy, you see the cover. The woman's either got a sword, a gun, or something. She's usually a kick-ass hero line, right? And this one here, she works for the DMV. She's about in her 30s, late 30s, been divorced. You know, it's a boring life. I mean, she's just like anybody, you know, nor ordinary.
Right.
But when she goes home one Friday afternoon thinking, oh, I need a warm, comfortable bath, and then going to order some pizza in, this vortex thing opens up by in her neighborhood and sucks her up. And so she goes into extraordinary circumstances of life, of going through meeting a couple of characters, Connor, who's a werewolf, and actually stuck in a werewolf form when she meets him, and because for 6 months, because he's been sucked up there 6 months ago from California. And then Larry, who's helped him, who's a demon, but he's in the shape of a giant eyeball, a large, very large eyeball. And you know, Larry, yeah. And they both get out of there, and of course the vortex is opens up downtown Richmond, and things start coming out, and it looks like hell's going, you know, literally take over the world, apocalypse is happening. And so in the long run, it's kind of like Cat has, that's the character Cat has to learn, her short for Kathleen, has to yeah, almost learn extraordinary circumstances will make her into the hero line she never thought she could be.
Great. That sounds like a great book. Yeah. So it's urban fantasy, but it's different. Yeah.
I guess.
Oh, Judith. Oh, yes. Judith, tell us about Swamp Rites.
Well, Swamp Rites is it's a kind of a cross genre between supernatural and horror, and it has a little racy romance in it for the adult in it. And it's basically about four 30-something women that were childhood friends, you know, from the time they were very small. And they had made a promise to each other that after 20 years that they would get together for a reunion. And a couple of the women, well, three of the women moved away, and only one remained in the town itself. And they, a couple of the three that moved away didn't want to go back because it just really was just a little swamp town that was just kind of decaying because there were shrimpers and fishermen that federal regulations had really made problems with. And anyway, they go back to the town and they find out that there's werewolves there. And it's kind of a bad situation when they realize that. And it's just got mm-hmm. some voodoo in it and some curses from that happens to be running the family as the one that has stayed behind. And then, you know, the next book continues on from there of the people that haven't lost their lives, I guess is the easiest way to say it, in the first book.
Right. All right. Great. So it sounds like it's sort of a mashup of genres.
I'm sorry, what was it?
It's sort of... It's a mashup of genres. It's not
well,
pure
yeah,
horror.
Yes, it is, because it's got some, you know, horror scenes in it, of course. But I guess it follows along the line of the, you know, the supernatural genre with the werewolf and you know, monster type supernatural creatures.
Okay, great. Pamela, you have a short story called Silence, which is in an anthology. Can you give us a little taste of what Silence is about?
Well, it was a Halloween anthology, so it had to be set or at least close to Halloween, which it was. It's a little short story where this man comes to town, and he's realizing it's really quiet in town, and he can't understand what's going on, and he goes all over, and he place where his girlfriend works at, it's closed, and it shouldn't be, because it's that time where everybody's going, getting ready to go into work. They stop out for coffee or at coffee shops and things like that. And he just can't understand, but he starts, and it's really silent, and he ends up being forced to chase something across this field in Long Run. He gets out of town, and when he sees these flashing lights, and what it was, and I will admit the ending, it's in the anthology, they can find it online at Amazon, that he comes to find out he's dead. And he had died in a car accident, and the paramedics are there, and his girlfriend's crying, of course, over his body, and it's his spirit. And of course, he ends up being, you know, led away by death to the other side because he didn't know. I mean, that's why it was so silent. The town had nobody in it because he's in another kind of in between death and we are.
So. In life, yeah. All right, that sounds good. Yeah, Judith. The Swamp Rites is the first book of a trilogy, and then there's Swamp Legacy. And you're working on Swamp Inheritance?
Yes, I am. It's a trilogy. I don't know if I'm going to extend it, but it seems like every time I get to the end, I get requests for another book because the people that are reading it seem to like the characters. So I haven't decided yet, but I'm about not quite halfway through the third book and hope to have it published. Well, hopefully in November so that it'll have it out for Christmas.
Wow. So you don't know if this is going to be a three-book trilogy or a 100-book trilogy, 100-book series, because people keep asking for more?
Well, it's possible. It just kind of depends when I already have the ending plotted out, so it just depends that when we get to that and what kind of results I get once I put the books on the market. You know, if they're still interested, it's always possible to put a twist in there and come up with a foursome of it.
Yep, sure is. Pamela, you're working on a supernatural horror novel tentatively titled Nowhere Land. Can you give us a hint of what that's going to be about?
Well, it's spooky. It's definitely, you know, it's not urban fantasy, though there's horror in Vortex, and I've been told it by readers, but they still like that party, the romance. It's more supernatural. There's investigators in this land. This land has been cursed for centuries, and people would either go across it and disappear, and maybe they find, maybe once in a while, a finger or something. Well, the last group of investigators, when this man and his sister inherited, they moved from California. Their grandfather died. They inherited it. He brings in the investigators to see if it's really haunted, because he wants to turn it into a historical attraction. It's set in Virginia, which is in kind of near Gloucester, so he wants to do like Williamsburg and Clinton Williamsburg, all that stuff, to turn it into a historical attraction. Because his family had settled this, and they had, of course, all disappeared except for his ancestor, who was a little boy at the time in the 1700s. And he has an investigator stay overnight there. And when he comes back in the morning, they're all gone. All they can find is a thumb. In the first chapter, we see what happens to the investigators. I mean, they all disappear horribly. There's something there. But it goes on from there because it'll be that's when another investigative team ahead of it convinces an old friend that he knew for years, who's a medium, has not been back in the investigating stuff for a long time because she had a sister that died in an accident on investigation. Nothing supernatural, more just regular lightning striking her and all that and killing her. So she grieves, but she has a past with this land too, because she used to live with it near it as a child and almost got her brother. If she had stopped it, she had developed her psychic abilities then and stopped him from going there. So there's a path to it, and she doesn't like the place. It's like bad juju. You don't want to go there, but she agrees, and they're going to stay there for several days with the owner of the land, the new owner of the land, investigating it, and things are going to happen, of course.
Of course. Do you have any idea when that's going to be available?
Right now, it's almost finished. I'm going through the edits, and then I'm going all that, and I'm pitching it to an agent. I like to try and see if I can get an agent or a publisher, and I want to try the big publishers first. That's why I said the agent. There's other ones that will be there, small press, and they do give you money up front, but I'm trying to get, like, that deal. So I'm pushing for that first. If it comes to a point, it can be self-published, but I'd rather if I see that one can go, because I'm thinking that might be the one that'll bring them over. We'll see.
Good luck with that. I admire you for trying that. Judith, you used to mainly write short stories. What got you into writing novels?
Well, it was kind of a personal situation. I had always had, kind of a backlog of things that I had written but had never turned into a novel. And I was getting the short stories published through the years. In fact, I just had one published last year in an anthology named Unleashed, and it was called The Wizard. And I had also, it had it first published back in 1979, and so I had it republished by somebody else back in 2017. So that was a long distance between it, but the story was still a good story. It was really a personal situation, and I promised myself that I was going to write three books, and I felt I had it in me to write at least three books. And I also have another novel that's totally along different lines. It's not the same as this, and it's, I guess, really more strictly straight supernatural about a demon. And I'm going to get to that as soon as I get finished with this third.
Pamela, you mentioned earlier you're going to Mysticon in Roanoke, Virginia next weekend, and StrokerCon in Providence, Rhode Island the weekend after that. And one of those places you're pitching to an agent, I can't remember which one. Why should authors go to cons?
Well, number one, as a person who used to be a fan for a long, long time, since 1972 was the first convention I ever went to. I lived in California, so I went to a lot of the ones in LA, the big ones and stuff. To hear, but I haven't been to Comic Con when it was first started out, the famous Comic Con San Diego when it was first. And I feel, because that's where I met a lot of my authors that I wanted to meet. I mean, Ray Bradbury, a lot of those, you know, I met them at these cons. And I feel that to me, and I try to tell other authors this, that if you can apply to be a guest or hopefully get on it, or even go, I guess nowadays, long can actually get tables at some of them authors' alleys and sell their books. You're going to meet your fans there, because those people going to those conventions of what you write are the fans that you're going to find. And, that kind of makes it nice when you get to see the face of the people, too. You know, you can write e-books, and I have stuff out in e-books and stuff for sale online. But when you meet somebody for face-to-face, and then they come back the next year looking for the next book, and they talk to you and all that. It's kind of nice, and it gets you, it's your people out there, and it's promoting you, the author. You're the brand, and you want everybody to know it. So when you're on panels, they get to know you that way and stuff like that, and know who you are and stuff. So I still think that's maybe the old way, but it's still a good way, my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, well, and good luck with your author pitch or your agent pitch. I admire you for doing that. I wish I could do that. Judith, you're from Louisiana, but now you live in Virginia. Why do you write about Louisiana instead of Virginia?
Well, I spent most of my life in Louisiana. I was born in Texas, but moved to Louisiana with my family when I was just a baby, and that's what I'm more familiar with. I moved to Virginia because my son married a Virginian, and they moved up here, and he wanted me to move up here, and so I did about 12 years ago, but I'm just much more familiar with the areas around Louisiana than I am here, and it's comfortable for me. I feel comfortable writing about what I'm what I remember and what I've seen most of my life. So that's why I write about the swamp and the areas that are around the New Orleans area and that type of thing.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. Do you include like Cajun culture and things like that in your novels?
Yes, I do, and I also include a lot of Cajun French, and and I interpret to what I mean. Some of the people talk Cajun French, and I let you know what they're saying, so you will know what's going on. And one of my main characters is a man who is becomes a wolf because he's bitten by the woman that is a wolf, but. Uh-huh. He speaks a lot of Cajun French, and I just recently, have been doing some book signings and at different venues, and I've had a lot of people that have bought the book back in November and December come back to the one in January that I did, and let me know how much they really liked it, and want to know when the next one's going to come out and that sort of thing. So.
All right, great. Isn't a Cajun werewolf a rougarou?
Are they what?
Have you ever heard the term rougarou?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay, somebody told me that's French Creole for werewolf. But they could be
wrong. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. Yes, it is. Yes, rougarou.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Okay. I said it wrong. Okay. All right. That makes sense. Pamela, tell us about Paranormal Pittsburgh, Virginia, and the Tri-Cities area.
Okay. That's nonfiction ghost books. It was actually the fifth in a series of nonfiction ghost books published by Schiffer Publishing that does nonfiction, and they have a ghost book division. And it's actually not set that far from me. It's a part of was in my two Richmond books, but a lot more because someone had asked me at his books, and I said, when are you going to, in Hopewell, which is part of the area, said, when are you going to do books? Aren't you going to do a book about Petersburg and Hopewell and all this area out here? And I didn't think about it until I tried some other thing to do with hotels, and Schiffer wouldn't do the hotel one because I guess something about not be able to sell the books or something through hotels, or I don't know what it was, but they didn't have anybody else doing it. So I said, well, I pitched the Petersburg one and the Tri-City, and they actually liked it. So I went there and, of course, did a lot of investigations. I have a ghost box. So I said, when I mention things in this nowhere land, those equipment are actual stuff that I know about. And, talk to spirits, I would actually make sure they were the real thing and not radio waves by asking questions or saying something that they couldn't tell, like the little boy in the one little restaurant, Wabi Sabi. I asked him about looking at my earrings at the time. It was Christmas. I was wearing snowman earrings. All I said was earrings. There's nobody in the room with me. The owner of the place had just went upstairs to help with something. And I said, do you see my earrings? And the little boy's voice came out of the box, says, snowman. Like that.
Oh.
So that's my way of proving, that they're a real thing. Plus, I have pictures. And it's a pretty good, I consider it the most haunted spot of actually all of Virginia that I've been to. Williamsburg has quoted, I wrote the book in that area, that they're the most haunted area, but Petersburg really could beat it if they would get their, all their act together, because the area has a lot of stuff going on. So there's for me, writing these things, I can tell you right now, I get ideas of real fake ghost stories from all this, because when you have the real stuff and the real stuff that actually happened, it gives you ideas.
Yep, I'm sure you do. Judith, you love dogs. What is it about dogs that you love so much?
Well, I've had dogs since I was a young child, and I just have an affinity with them. I've had all different kinds. I bred and showed Rottweilers for a few years, which was kind of the top of the dog at my list, the top dog at this. But I've had practically all kind, and I just I really like them. I enjoy them. That's about the only thing that I can say.
Well, why is it important for people to adopt dogs?
Well, I mean, I don't really find that much difference between a purebred or a mixed breed. I've had both, and I've loved both of them just the same. But, of course, having been in the show ring with my Rottweilers before, it's kind of an exciting thing to be involved with that, and I can understand why a lot of people would maybe rather a purebred. But the dogs that you see in the SPCA are just as sweet and loving most of the time as any purebred that's raised.
Yeah, my son adopted a rescue kitten, and from the animal shelter, and that cat has wormed its way into our hearts.
Yeah. Well, I have a feral cat that was born under my neighbor's house last year, and he has adopted me. He never went away, so he comes every morning at 7 o'clock in the morning and sits on the step to get fed. So I have a cat now, too.
Yep, that's cute. We'll be back with our guests, Pamela K. Kinney and Judith D. Howe, in a few moments.
You're listening to the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Right Stream Radio.
Now it's time for your shot of science, your jigger of scientific news. Today's story comes from, surprise, surprise, space.com. Most of my stories come from space.com. The link to the full story is on my blog, and the reason most of my stories come from space.com is because I'm sort of a space geek. Well, we always knew that the alien megastructure idea was a long shot. E.T. has nothing to do with the bizarre dimming events of the mysterious object known as Tabby's Star, a new study reports. Little dust is most likely the reason why the star's light appears to dim and brighten. Study leader Tabitha Bajoyan, an astronomer at Louisiana State University, said in a statement, "The new data shows that different colors of light are being blocked at different intensities. Therefore, whatever is passing between us and the star is not opaque, as would be expected from a planet or an alien megastructure." Tabby's Star, more formally known as KIC 8462852, lies about 1,500 light years from Earth and is a bit bigger and hotter than the Sun. The star has been in the news a lot since 2015 when a team led by Bajoyan found that it had dimmed dramatically over the previous 5 years or so, once by a whopping 22%. Further observations added to the intrigue. For example, a research team found that Tabby's Star had dropped in brightness overall by about 20% from 1980 to 1989. I typed the year there. For the past 2 years, astronomers have been trying to figure out what exactly is going on with Tabby's Star. A number of potential explanations have been floated, from orbiting comet fragments to a huge dust cloud between Earth and Tabby's Star to energy collecting structures built by an advanced alien civilization. Researchers always stressed that the last possibility was quite remote, and now it looks like we can cross it off entirely. For the new study, Bajoyan and her team observed KIC 8462852 from March 2016 to December 2017, using multiple ground-based telescopes run by the Las Columbus Observatory. They spotted and analyzed four separate dimming events which occurred in the summer of 2017. The new results were consistent with those of other research group, which late last year concluded that Tabby's Star is likely orbited by a cloud of dust that completes one lap every 700 Earth days. Bajoyan and her team funded the new observations via a Kickstarter campaign, which raised more than $107,000, which is appropriate because citizen scientists helped Bajoyan recognize the weirdness of Tabby's Star in the first place. Her 2015 paper was a collaboration with volunteers from the online group Planet Hunters, who sift through data gathered by NASA's Kepler Space Telescope looking for ancient worlds. Kepler spots the tiny dimming events caused by orbiting planets crossing the star's face from the spacecraft's perspective. KIC 8462852, or Tabby's Star, a massive brightness dip stood out in the Kepler data set as something very different. So there's no Dyson sphere around Tabby's star. It's just dust. And that is today's shot of science.
This is the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Rightstream Radio.
And we are back with our guests, Pamela K. Kinney and Judith D. Howe. If you'd like to speak with our guests or ask a question, please call 347-945-7246. That's 347-945-7246. And here's the part you need to remember. Press 1 on your phone to be put in the queue for going on the air. I think it even says press 1 to talk to the host. So press 1 to be put in the queue for going on the air, or otherwise I won't get the signal that you want to go on the air, and you won't go on the air. That's 347-945-7246. And press that one key to go on the air. Pamela, do you have something to read to us today?
Yes, I do. It's going to be from How the Vortex Changed My Life.
Great. Go ahead when you're ready.
Okay. I'll go right ahead now. Connor and I arrived at some stone steps. We clattered up them and into the Richmond Public Library. After we stepped into the foyer and passed the circulation desk, we looked around, unsure where to go. I saw a room to the left of us, pointed at it, and we slipped inside. Rows and rows of books and shelves lined the area like soldiers marching behind each other. A portly man in khaki pants, white shirt, and a blue flower tie sat behind a desk. He looked up and smiled. "Can I be of assistance?" His smile faltered as he stared past me. He seen Larry. "This won't be good," stood his forehead wrinkling. "That's pretty lifelike. What is it? A balloon? I can't see any string attached to it." Decided not to beat around the bush, I blurted, "He's not a balloon. He's an eyeball. Actually, he's a demon." The man said, "Are you trying to say that whatever it is alive?" "Kinda. I guess demons are sort of alive." The librarian walked over to us and poked at Larry. Larry didn't like it and started that weird bleeding noise he could make and bumped against the man. He bumped him so hard he almost knocked the librarian over. The man managed to stay on his feet and took a couple of steps back as he wiped the finger on his pants as if Larry had given him cooties. Connor grabbed the librarian by the same finger and squeezed hard. The man cried out. Connor let go. "Larry doesn't like people poking at him," he glared. "It's rude. Besides, how would you like it if I poked at you?" Connor proceeded to do just that. The librarian stumbled back. Okay, but what is that thing? The lady called it a demon, but demons aren't real, right?" Connor snorted. "That thing is a demon, like the lady said. If it wasn't for him, I'd been dead within hours after I got trapped in hell." Larry bumped against Connor and made another noise I've never heard before, like a cat's purr. "I find Larry is a lot more human than you humans are." "Well, you look as human as the rest of us," said the librarian with a snotty attitude. "And that eye beastie definitely doesn't." He narrowed his eyes. "This library is for humans only. I mean, non-human things can't get a library card issued to them." He saw Connor give him a glowering look and inched away. "Well, I'm pretty sure that's the rules." I spoke up. "We're not here to borrow a book." I snuck a look at the front entrance. "We needed a place to hide in. You see, a monster is after us. A very big monster. And there are others outside like us, and Larry here. A vortex opened not far from here, and downtown Richmond is turning gray, and I don't mean Confederate gray either. Richmond's new address is now a part of the hell dimension. The whole world is doomed. And I don't think it really matters where Larry can be issued a library card or what species can use this library." The librarian's mouth opened and shut in shock, his eyes bulging and looking like tennis shoes balls. He sputtered. You're nuts." He cut a glance at Larry, who hovered closer to him. "I think you guys are pulling something on me. That thing has to got to be fake." I grabbed him by his ugly tie. "Look, hell is taking over Richmond, and soon Virginia, not long after the U.S., and from there, maybe the world. So get over it. Larry is not fake. He's a demon, plain and simple, but maybe you can't comprehend it. I know I couldn't at first. That means no more people checking out books, no more Christmas, cute fluffy kittens, no more anything good and right for humankind, just demons, hell, and end of life as we know it." The librarian ripped his tie out of my hand and looked at me like I had sprouted horns and a pitchfork myself. I must have been tougher on him than I thought. A growl reached my ears, along with an awful Miss Small climbing up my nostrils. I reeled around. With an African-American lady library and class in one claw paw and a patron speared by the claws of the other, the monster that had been chasing us stood by the circulation desk. The patron kept screaming while the librarian hung unconscious and limped like a wet noodle. I watched with horror as the monster snarled and slurped the patron's head into its mouth, effectively cutting off the screaming. The librarian with us took off, yelling something about monsters not being in his job description. Connor grabbed my hand again and drew me toward the elevators. He kept pushing at the button for up, one eye on the monster now busy eating the rest of its meal. It still clutched the librarian, who hadn't yet regained consciousness. Finally, the elevator door slid open with a ping, and Connor thrust me inside, with Larry and him crowding in right behind. He punched the button for the second floor, and the door slid shut. I began to cry, not dainty little tears, but big ones that redden your face. It had been a terrible Friday so far, with working a long shift at the DMV, handling irate customers, and then ending up in the corridor outside of Hell's Dimension. Now it looked like I would become Purina Dr. Chow for some demonic creature, and the world would be destroyed. My life sucked. I'd give anything to have my old, boring old existence back. Our ride stopped, and the door pinged, sliding open. We stepped out into the second floor. People stood to the left of us, staring over the banister. Horrible sounds drifted up from the first floor, and I knew what the looky-loos watched. Connor grabbed a metal statue and swung it, slamming it hard against the buttons. A flash of smoke, a buzzing sound, and the elevator became useless. He looked at me and shrugged. At least the monster won't be able to use it. Though being a demon, I won't promise it won't be able to magic its way up here. He glanced at the onlooker still staring down at the first floor. Hey! Over there. If you're all smart, you better find a way out of here, or someone may watch you being eaten alive. Only one person appeared to have heard him, and the man turned to give us a wide-eyed look. Then he swept his gaze back to the scene down below. Stupid, stupid idiots. Connor snorted. Come on, let's find another way out. And I'll leave it there.
Oh, my. Well, I assume she doesn't get eaten by the monster or the eels.
No.
Okay, that was exciting. Thank you for sharing that.
And that's a real library, too, in Richmond.
I know, yeah. Judith, do you have something to read for us today?
Yes, I'm going to be reading something from Swaprite, and it's when one of the characters, whose name is Yancy, changes into a wolf for the first time. It had been a quiet, uneventful day that filled her with a hunger for fresh fish and urged her towards her favorite fishing spot. Luck was with her. The fish were hungry. Several big-whiskered mudcats hung in the bayou from a stringer pole leaning against a cypress knee. As dusk quenched the remainder of daylight, emerging dark thread last rays of sun into indigo ribbons. Yancy leaned sleepily against a moss-covered oak log, admiring the flash of silver tinsel from the few stars that had appeared. A chilly wind, heavy with sour and salt and fish spawn odor, whistled through the ferns and reeds. A raw, itchy discomfort started in her hands. A pin-pricking sensation of pain began to travel up her arms. Her vision blurred. Tissue vibrated at the corners of her mouth and eyes. Her temples began to throb. She clutched her head, disoriented, confused over what was happening to her. The jolting pain that followed was agonizing. The force of it threw her forward to the ground. Face pressed hard against the odious soil, she sucked in hissing breath. The urgent need to vomit overcame her. On fire from the inside out, she rolled herself onto her hands and knees, quivering as the impact of what was happening resonated through flesh and bone. Mucus and blood and pale smoke oozed from her splitting skin. Shock and terror rose as screams that froze inside her chest. Her eyes were wide, reflective pools of fear. She thought she was dying. A transparent, glistening lump of flesh formed, outlined jutting angular bones, and she was neither what she had been nor what she would be. The first spiky tufts of fur appeared. flickered into a dark mask, and an extraordinary sable covered her entire body. Her face elongated into a wide black snout. Ivory fangs erupted, gleaming in the moonlight. Long, muscular legs filled out. Hocks and haunches grew thick, extended into massive paws and thick nails cushioned by large, soft paws. A broad plume of tail erupted. The stretching and twisting and popping finally ended, and all pain vanished. She forced herself to her feet, stood shaky and confused. Her vision cleared, bringing everything sharply into focus. Her skin tingled, nostrils quivered, and began to leak. Her hearing amplified. She was fascinated to hear the minute sounds, the repetitious tick-tick of evening dew sliding off plant leaves, the unfurl of curled fern, a gator stirring in the distant water, a far-off splash, fish slicing their way between tight tree roots, the snicker of prey sliding under cover from a predator, a sleepy bird cooing into its breast in a remote tree, a stealthy rabbit sneaking through weeds, and an owl ruffling its feathers. A strange excitement warmed her blood. She yearned, stretching out her front legs, and dug her toenails into soft earth, shaking vigorously head to tail. She delighted in the weight of the heavy pelt, prize, an unexpected deep rumble in her belly. She could almost taste the hot blood she craved, pumping down her throat, the soft melt of tender bruised flesh against her tongue. Flesh, alive, hot, and flush with blood. Her heart leaped against her ribcage as she coughed up a whisper of sound, a soft woof that turned from a grudging sliver of noise way down in her chest and crawled quickly, like choked-off laughter, up through her throat as she threw back her head and gave voice to an experimental howl. Yancey came to and left the hideous blackness behind. She lay naked in the tall weeds. Reality arrived with a painful surge of blood in her temples. The pain, the bestial feelings, the hot pump of blood in veins, the solid thrust of muscle in leg and haunch, the snap of twigs and the feel of hard ground rushing by beneath her running feet, the cut and slap of tall grass and weeds around her muzzle, the chilling thrill of crisp night wind whipping through her pelt, the hunger. Her heart lunged, nearly stopped, as she opened up her body to the night. Her first kill. She fastened her canines into the kicking hindquarters of her prey. The struggle, the fright and squeal of death, the warm pulse of blood as it poured down her throat when she sank her fangs into the animal's throat, bearing the thrashing, wild-eyed young doe to the ground. The thrill that came with the weight of the hot, hard body under her own, and gorging herself on soft innards and tender meat, flushed through her like fire. And I'll just stop there.
Okay.
Hello?
Hello. Sorry, I was recovering. Oh, wow. That was great. That was very descriptive. And No. You've never been turned into a werewolf before, because it sounds like you knew a lot about it.
Yeah, she turned into the wolf and then became a werewolf, and, you know, through that. But they are just regular wolves also. So,
Pamela, what do you find most challenging about writing, other than finding the time, which everybody has that challenge?
Oh, gosh. Probably writing outlines. Actually, when I'm moderating at StokerCon, I'm moderating outlining versus pantsing, so that'll be interesting. Because I think I'm not only an outliner. I'm a pantser mostly, but I'm also kind of an outliner. What I is this is how I've always done it since high school. I mean, I get straight A's in English, but I fool them when they ask for an outline with your work. I would write the workout first and then outline it afterwards. That's been the way I've been all my life. And what I do in novels or long novellas that I've had, if I want to, you know, I do write an ending, because to me there should be an ending you can go to. What I do is I'll write the last few chapters down, kind of telling myself things that I thought that should progress toward. But I also write, I have a list of all my characters down, and a new one shows up, I put it in there, and I describe them. I give them job. Even if it doesn't end up having the job, I just think about it. It may not end up showing in the manuscript. It might be a minor character or something. It's all written down because I want to know their color, their eyes. I don't want to mess up because I've read enough books where I can catch that because I also review books for review blogs, so I do know when things mess up. So I'm kind of a pantser, and reading about pantsers, I don't think I'm a pantser as they think of. It's like there's no – I really have a set system. I can't explain it, but I see it in my head, and I see it in color, and it always comes through to me like that. And so I do know the ending and the beginning, all that stuff. So it just comes out that way. And I've written quite a few novels and novellas that way, and not one of my publishers that I've had publishers have said – a thing against it, so and a couple of them won awards. One an award, so you know.
All
but
right.
that's interesting. Is the outlying part? I'm just not a outliner. That's
all right.
Hard. I know that eventually that will hit, but have to do it. But
yeah, no, I'm the same way. I don't outline, and I'm on a panel tomorrow. No, Sunday. About outlining and pantsing, and I'm gonna be the pantsing delegation because I'm pretty much a pantser. And yeah, the eyes changing color or something like that—that's something you really got to work hard at when you're a pantser, is to make sure you don't do that.
That's why I put this list of all
ahead.
My stuff characters and I write it down. Let me tell you something I found out. I never thought he was until the last few days. I actually saw a big author mention him and somebody else. And this is going to be a shock probably to most people. It shocked me because I thought, because he used to teach English, okay? He wrote a book,
right.
And he made a writing book, and he made he taught English. Stephen King is a pantser.
Yeah. I
did not
know
that. I thought he would outline all the.
Somehow
that was the biggest shock to me to learn that this last few days.
Yeah. Pamela, I'm going to ask you the same question. Or not Pamela, excuse me, Judith. I'm going to ask you the same question. What do you find most challenging about writing other than finding the time?
Well, I don't outline. I write. Whenever, usually I'll write a whole chapter at a time. And I carry a style notebook with me wherever I go, even if I go to grab a hamburger for lunch or something like that. And I sit down and I can write a chapter or two chapters maybe while I'm eating my hamburger and then come home and put it into the computer. And then I go over my stuff after I do that. I mean, add things and subtract things after I get it into the computer, maybe two or three times before I'm satisfied with what I have, you know. But I know my characters pretty well, and I don't have, you know, that much of a problem just following through with whatever I'm writing about them and carrying them forward. So I've never been one that's made outlines to you know, keep up with them. Of course, I may have to go back if I use a character in a second book and maybe look up something that I might have forgotten. But I guess maybe a lot of people do that too. So.
Yeah, I've done that. I actually had a character I killed in the first book come back in the second book. In that first draft, and then later I realized, oh, he's dead. He can't come back.
Yeah.
So I had to come up with a new character for that scene. But,
well,
you gotta be careful.
Different people
fans.
Do different ways, you know. So, and you do whatever you're comfortable with. I think the most thing is the biggest challenge and the most things that you should kind of watch is here that you do have kind of believable characters and that your conversation between your characters and that type of stuff is realistic, you know, and moves pretty well.
Yep. Okay. Pamela, why should anybody buy your books? Why should anybody buy your books?
Well, I'm hoping that I have got entertaining books that will, and actually you should buy all books in my opinion, because any book is good as a comfort. And I'm hoping that mine are just like, I would say they're like comfort food. there's something that you can relax and enjoy. If you enjoy horror, if you enjoy, I write science fiction, I write fantasy. Mm-hmm. If you enjoy that, the ghost books, then that's like comfort food. And something about, you know, books, reading mine, I'm hoping will make it entertain the person and make them feel enjoyed that they had an enjoyable time reading it. That's what I hope that my books will bring to people. And like any other author, you know, you want them to know, I want them to know my world, my worlds that are in my head.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. I mean, I make a little money writing, but I'm mostly interested in being read by strangers. You know, I want people who don't know me to read me, because, you know, my wife reads me, and my mother reads me, and my friends read me, but I want to be read by strangers. That's my whole goal. Judah, same question. Why should anybody buy your books?
Well, I think I have pretty interesting characters, and I usually go into depth with them pretty much, and their lives are all tangled in with everything that's going on in the book, and I have also in the second book I have a psychotic killer, and one of my characters is an attorney, and he gets involved with a lot of things like that. But most of the people, like you were saying about strangers reading the books, that's basically who buys my books. And I've had a lot of good response where, you know, people have come back and told me they really enjoy them, and they forward to the next book.
Right. Pamela, what motivates and inspires you?
What inspires me? It would probably be that I just have to keep writing. I've always been like that since I was 8 years old. I used to write stuff as an 8-year-old kid on up, make up stories with animals, actually science fiction back then, and other stuff like that. I've always done it. And then when I got first time published at 17 with poetry, in a magazine that I got paid for, and that was incredible for me at that time in 1972. Believe me, $5 a poem is what I got paid. So it's $15. That was a lot back then. That's what they pay now for a poem. And so I was inspired. I want to get my stories out. It's fine, you know. I want people to enjoy my stories, and I want to enjoy that they're out there, people, and enjoying it. So it's like wanting to get it out. There's always something coming in my head. I've learned over the last few years how to control my mind, because as someone said, I have a pretty big imagination, obviously, and I would start writing other stuff, and I control it now so that it's mostly like one novel at a time, so that it can stick to that. Though I may add occasionally stories in, like I actually going to be writing a short story, because there's an anthology call for horror writers, so I'm looking for it for kids type stories based off some famous book from years ago, Scary Story to Tell in the Dark, that they're going to aspire like that. And so I do write that occasionally, but most of it is to control myself. So I have so much stories in my head, believe me. It's like voices that just want me to tell their story. So that inspires me all the time that they're talking to me. So,
I can imagine. Getting published at 17, I think I got published at 47, my first paid publication. And it was nonfiction. It was an article I wrote for a local
congratulations.
Paper.
See, you got published. And that's our viewpoint, right? We want to be there.
We want to be read by strangers. That's my goal. Pamela, we're almost to the end of the show. We're wrapping up here. Is there anything I forgot to ask you about? Anything you got to get out before the show's over?
I think you did pretty well.
Okay. All right. Judah, same thing. Anything you want to make sure we say before the end of the show?
No, other than just to say that I was glad to be on your show tonight, and I hope that, you know, I'll hear back from some of those strangers again when they purchase my books again through hearing what they heard on your show. I think
I hope
was very
so, too.
Good. Yeah.
Thank you. All right. So I'd like to thank my guests, Pamela K. Kinney and Judith D. Howe. Again, more information on both these writers is on my blog at blog.s7townsend.com. That's blog.s7townsend.com. There's links to their books, links to their social media, links to all that stuff. So go check that out at blog.s7townsend.com. Judith, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And Pamela, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And to all of my listeners, this is the last episode of the Speculative Fiction Cantina. We started doing the show on October 10th, 2014. Since then, I have done 177 shows, including this one. 165 shows, including this one, have been live, so 12 have been pre-recorded. We've had approximately 300 guests. It's hard to say how many guests we've had because sometimes a guest won't call in who's scheduled, or, well, that's usually what would happen. I've had four special guests. I had a rocket scientist who's also a science fiction writer. I had an academic science fiction expert and author of books about how science fiction influenced World War II. And most recently, not a couple of weeks ago, I had a literary agent on to talk about her work. It's been fun, and I will miss it. And thank you, everyone, who is a listener to the Speculative Fiction Cantina. And if you're in South Central Washington and you want to come to RadCon, look for me. I'll be wearing a brown fedora. That is me. So, again, thank you, everyone, and goodbye.
This has been the Speculative Fiction Cantina on RightStream Radio.